Hello and welcome to the latest episode of our Religion at Work podcast. I'm your host, Binna Kandola, and I'm the senior partner at Pern Kandola, a practice of business psychologists. And so far in the series, we've explored how different religions intersect with the modern workplace. And today, I'm really delighted to continue this discussion with Pritpal Bulla, who is a senior human resources business partner in the UK's Ministry of Defence, and he is deputy chair of the Defence Seek Network. And Pritpal is going to be talking to us about being Sikh in today's workplace. And
hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you here.
Absolutely, yes. And it's a delight to be here.
Well, I wouldn't mind just starting off, actually, if you can just kind of give us a bit of background to yourself.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Pritpal Bulla. I have worked as a civil servant for nearly 24 years. So I've worked across government and with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, with the Home Office, and currently I'm with the Ministry of Defence. I've had the opportunity to work overseas in various locations, as well as across the UK in a wide range of roles, which range from frontline delivery of services, such as working for the Immigration Service or as a diplomat for the Foreign Office, but as well as working in more specific sort of HR and project type roles in more latter years.
Of most interest to us today is actually that you are a practicing Sikh.
I am a practicing Sikh, and yeah, really proud to talk about my faith. And obviously, Sikhs are probably the most visible people in our communities and in our societies, and that goes very much to the heart of the essence of who we are as Sikhs, about being visible, so that we can be there to help and support people who are in need. So by being visible as a Sikh, people should be able to come to me and seek safety, security, sanctuary, whatever they need. And I should be ready and in a position, because that's a commitment I give to my guru, to be there for others when they need me.
I've been to Sandhurst, actually, and there's actually a window, isn't there? Like a stained glass window with Sikh soldiers on it.
So are you talking about the India room?
Is that what it is? Yeah.
Yeah, so the India room is a prestigious room in Sandhurst where anything important happens in that room. So yeah, it's quite an iconic room.
Yeah, and there are Sikhs represented on the stained glass windows, aren't there?
Yes, there is. I mean, you have to remember Sikhs get a lot more kudos for being in the military, certainly in the during the Indian Army, than other faiths. But we have to recognise that actually Sikhs only formed about 20% of the Indian Army, British Indian Army, but they were probably the group that was shown off the most, as we've seen in history. So if you go to Hampton Court Palace at the moment, for example, they have an exhibition on about Sikhs at Hampton Court Palace. So it shows when Sikhs have been coming to the coronation in the UK since early 1900s, after the death of Queen Victoria, and they were always a feature at the coronation, and they were paraded around the UK, and I'd literally been paraded around, because they were all around the country to be shown off. So they got a lot more kudos, and certainly within the Sikh community, we probably did have a huge representation. So if you think of British India, Sikhs would have formed about 0.5% of the population, but we formed 20% of the armed forces. So we were far bigger than our representation. So within the Sikh community, it's a big thing. And I say both my grandfathers were both in the British Indian Army and fought in the Second World War. So for many, it is part of our history, particularly those of us that have been settled in the UK. Many of the migrants that came over post-Second World War were those that had been demobbed from the British Army following the end of the war. And then many of the officers that were in the, for example, in the Sikh regiments were white, English, British, but had been over in India for generations. So Major Henderson, who was a major from my grandfather's regiment, he taught me how to speak Punjabi, for example, and used to laugh at me. And when I pronounced some of the words wrong and the sounds wrong. But his family were in India for seven generations, but before they came back to the UK after when the British left India after the Second World War. So there is a huge connection. So so the India room there has got the stained glass window with a man in a turban, and I can't remember off the top of my head if it's a Sikh or not, because turbans, again, are not, if you go to around the world, but certainly to, you know, back to India in those days, were not exclusive just for Sikhs. There were different styles of turbans worn by different communities. So you might want to then ask, well, actually, how do you differentiate between a Sikh turban? So a lot of the turbans originally were worn by nobility or people who were very in prominent positions in religious institutions. So it was literally by people who were at the top of society. And because we believe in equality, our view was, well, actually, nobody's at the top of society because we're all the same and we're all equal. So actually, we're all wear turbans and we'll all be identifiable. But there are very many different styles of Sikh turbans. I remember in the early days of the internet, for example, one of my favorite go-to websites used to be, findmysikhturbanstyle.com. Where loads of people just used to post photographs of their various turban styles and stuff. And that used to be quite good fun.
Are there regional differences then in terms of
Yeah, there's loads of differences. So Sikhs, obviously, once they were part of the British Empire, went all around the world. So there are different styles that come from, you can recognize an African type, East African style turban versus an Indian style one or a Punjabi one versus, some of them are warriors types, Nihang styles. So there are lots of different styles of turbans. I often sort of ask the question, what's my style? And people go, well, I'm not quite sure, but it's definitely not any of
Well, for sure.
the styles that we
You've got
recognize.
your own authentic style.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are distinctive styles, and also colors as well. I mean, you can choose whatever color we want, but some people choose to, have traditions where they wear particular colors because it may well have been that, I'm sure, for example, East Africa, one of the common styles there is a white turban. And the reason it's not necessarily a religious reason is because the white material was re really readily and easily available in East Africa for turbans, so that's why they wore them. So there are different styles and different types of turbans that we all wear as well. Yeah, my style, I think, probably comes back from the British Army. I would say the style that was probably developed in the later years of the British Army, but again, that's changed over time as well. Because if you look at in the 1800s, the Sikhs that were in the British Army would have worn very different styles to what I'm wearing now.
It's quite handy having an army styled one, being in the MOD.
Not when I work for the Air Force.
Yeah, really. Yeah, wow. And then the what are the colours and that are associated with the faith?
Two main ones I would say would be probably saffron and blue, sort of like a dark blue. The question would be why. So the reason is because if you go to any Sikh place of worship, Gurdwara, it's called. The Gurdwara will always have what's called a Nishan Sahib. Now, to describe it, I could describe it like a flag, but it would be incorrect for me to describe it as a flag because a Nishan Sahib means a symbol. Okay, so it's a symbol, and the reason it flies, anywhere where our guru goes is because it shows that that's a place where you can be fed, you can find shelter. You can get safety and you'll be protected. So it's a symbol for people to say, this is a place, a sanctuary that you can come to and you will be safe and you will be protected.
You said you can be fed. Who can be fed?
Anybody. So anybody can go to any Gurdwara anywhere in the world. And one of the things in a Gurdwara, we have to have what's called a communal kitchen, which is a langar in Punjabi. So there will be a langar in every Gurdwara in the world. So if you ever see a Gurdwara, place where Sikhs congregate, there will be a communal kitchen in there. You can go in and be fed at any time. You'll get a hot meal. You'll get lots of smiles and welcomes and eat as much as you like. If you like Punjabi food, then that's the place to head and you'll get it for free. And this is all, and this all goes back to the basics of the Sikh faith around sharing and giving. And langar actually is a really good way of demonstrating the equality of people. So I, as in a position of power in some of the roles that I do, for example, could still be going in and serving people or being served by people who will be in a very different position, potentially. And there's some really powerful historical narratives that we can pick up as well, where the Sikh armies in the past would always go out and would look after, tend to the wounded of the other side and feed their prisoners and look after them. And in the Sikh kingdom, it's known that there were no prisons because we had what was called justice, and everybody was looked after and protected. So, and our gurus would also build places of worship for other people. So, there are times when the Sikhs were told to go and build mosques or to build Hindu temples and such like, so that people of other faiths could go and practice their faith. So it's all about serving. It's about dignity for one another. It's about, equality, and all of us ha having access to the basics and the bare minimum that we need. So if we're hungry, for example, how will you ever be able to how will you ever be able to worship? Because your focus will be on your hunger. If you're cold and wet and you haven't got somewhere, some shelter to go and seek, how will you ever be able to connect with the divine? Because your focus will be on seeking heat.
And how do you how does that your faith, how does that manifest itself in the workplace?
So essentially, obviously, the visible form is seeing me as a man with wearing a turban. That identifies me very much as a Sikh. But actually, this can actually cause confusion. I went, I remember going to a European interfaith event, EuroPride last year in Malta, and having a cross section of people that I was on a platform with. I sort of randomly said to the minibus when we were being taken to our venue for a meeting that, what religion do you think I am? And I got Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, everything but Sikh. So although we're visible and we're identifiable, there is also confusion around what my turban represents. One of the most obvious things about my faith these days is certainly when we're doing international travel as Sikhs. I'll quite often be traveling through, for example, European airports particularly, and all of a sudden I'll see all the eyes are on me. And they'll all be looking at me, and they'll all be, I can see them sort of getting ready for whichever channel I go to. And quite often, I like to travel in business class or premium travel, so it'll be sort of one of the premium lanes. And I will be questioned, and I'll be scrutinized. Extra checks will be put in place for me because I'm perceived as a threat. But they don't understand that actually I come to them with love, and actually I would be the one who will be able to provide them with help, safety. Sikhs are well known generally for going out and feeding the homeless and providing them with the things that they need. And it's a shame that some of those stereotypes around some of the good things that we do don't make it necessary to, certain communities and countries and authorities who perceive us as a threat because they mistake us to be sometimes Islamic extremists.
And that's because you're brown and you wear a turban.
Absolutely. It's a a classic sign of confusion.
I mean, that's kind of when you're traveling. But what have you noticed I mean, you've worked in all sorts of different environments at quite and actually increasingly at senior levels in the civil service. What sort of experiences have you had in the workplace?
So it's funny because if you go back 20 years ago when I was very much a junior civil servant, working in the UK generally has been this is my country of birth. It's the country where Sikhs are very at home and have been part of the establishment, established communities for at least 150 years. So, we're recognized and well known. And so, generally in the UK, I would say life is less problematic for a practicing Sikh. But a lot of my work has taken me into places where Sikhs are not so visible. So when I was a student, for example, so my background, I was studying French and German at university. So I went to university in France. Little town of Clermont-Ferrand was where I was sent to. And I remember when I was being given my university overseas from my university here in Birmingham, I had to, other students could all choose where they wanted to go, just from where they wanted to go. I had to go sit down with the head of the department to sit down and work out which ones would be the safest for me to go to because I wouldn't be attacked for the color of my skin and my faith identity. So Clermont-Ferrand was chosen because it was a small town. there's less migrants there, it's less likely that you'd get caught up in problems with racism and all these sorts of things that are probably much more at the forefront of conversations these days in the UK too than they would have been 25, 30 years ago. But there were at that time in France still lots of problems with race, particularly. So this just goes to show that I don't get that same experience because I still have to think about things like, well, how's it going to affect my personal security? How's it going to affect my life? And certainly when I've been overseas as a diplomat, when I when I turn up to do something as a British diplomat, people get be looking around to go, but where's the real British diplomat? Because it doesn't look like you, and there weren't very many people that looked like me probably operating in those circles at the time. But then obviously when I was speaking back in French or German or other languages, it sets out a course of confusion. So this is just showing you that there is a lot of prejudice, particularly with people who aren't necessarily familiar with Sikhs. I mean, Sikhism is known as I think it's the fifth largest religion in the world, which sounds quite big. But if you think about our population of Sikhs, we number about 30 million around the whole world. So the UK population is at about 70 million. So if you're looking at 30 million Sikhs spread across the world, we are actually quite thinly spread, even though we are recognized as a world religion and as the one of the youngest world religions, really.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's when you take the world's population to be the fifth largest religion and it's 30 million, that's kind of 0.00%, isn't it? I mean,
It's a tiny pin drop, but that I think that then just also amplifies and makes me even more proud around the impact that the Sikhs have had around the world. Because if you the history that we have, which the more and more I learn and more I share, I get more and more proud about actually. Because I think actually even though Sikhism is only 550 years old, we have such a rich, such a fascinating history to share with the world, and I think more people should know about it.
Yeah, thank you. What made you get involved with the Sikh network?
So I, along with the chair of the network at the time, was the founder of the network, the Defence Sikh Network.
Oh, you founded it?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, it was a bringing together of. So there used to be like an armed forces network and a civil service network, and what we did was that the civil servants and the armed forces all worked together for the Ministry of Defence. So we brought together what's called the Defence Sikh Network, which brings together those that are serving with the Army, Navy, the Air Force, and the civil service that work with them all together in one network because we all work for the Ministry of Defence. So it's a way of being able to bring a small group of people. We are in our hundreds as in an organisation which is hundreds of thousands strong. So we're again very small, as we talked about before, and about bringing us all together so that we can all work together for a better experience for Sikhs across defence, and also so we can create a community, we can create opportunities for shared practice, and whether that shared practice would be ch shared charity pursuits or shared religious practice or whatever, it's a great way of us to be brought together. I mean, for example, if you've got somebody in the Ministry of Defence who's deployed to the Falkland Islands, there probably won't be another Sikh for thousands and thousands of miles away from them. So it's a way of being able to bring us together as a community that we can actually have a shared connection with those of us that share, because we're, as Sikhs, we don't only just share our religious beliefs, but we also share a history. We share lots of cultural, culinary, loads of different language, lots of different elements that we share. So it's about bringing all of those things together as a community for us. So it's not necessarily always about religion.
And how do you do all of that then? I mean, that's quite a lot of things for a small group of people to do.
So what we do is we have representatives from each of the services who are led by an executive team. So we've got so the executive team has a chair, a deputy chair, and a secretary who sort of run the network on a day-to-day basis on top of their normal jobs that they would do. So these aren't full-time jobs. These are what people volunteering to do these roles. So they will provide the leadership. So what the leadership will do is decide the strategy for the network for a 2-year period, And then you'll have a lead for each one of the services. So you'll have an army lead, an RAF lead, a navy lead, and a civil service lead. And then the four of them will work within their services to be able to understand what the issues are pertinent for their workforces. And then that then gets brought up at an exec level. And from that, we build a strategy. So the types of things that we do are, for example, is carry out surveys with those that are members of the Sikh network. And to be a member of the Sikh network, you don't have to be a Sikh, for example. You can be a non-Sikh who has an interest in being involved in the Sikh network too. You know, we're all about it. Sikhism is all about inclusion. I mean, if you think about 500 years ago, how women were oppressed all over the world. Guru Nanak Dev Ji, the founder of the Sikh faith, fought for women's equality, which, if you think 500 years ago, would have been a fundamentally different thing. So, when in modern days, in the modern day period, when we hear about things like, you know, questions about whether women can be priests and lead religious worship and all these sorts of things, these are never conversations that we've had to have in the Sikh faith because the founder, Guru Nanak, started with, you know, we are all divine. We are all equal, and we are all part of the one divinity. So it's helpful for us to be able to bring this together. So for us, it's really important that we do have, for example, women representatives as well. So we'll make sure that we try and have women in leadership roles on the executive team within the leadership areas as well. So we'll survey our members to try and understand what they would like us to do for them. So some of the things that were problematic. If you think about somebody who joins the armed forces, on day one you get issued with your uniform, and then a Sikh turns up and they're going, how does my turban fit in with this uniform? You know, there is no answer, and quite often in training there was no answer, and people just had to sort of make it up in different training establishments. So one of the things we've done, for example, is we formalize what's called the Sikh dress guides, armed forces dress guides. So we have a dress guide which is for the armed for the RAF, for the army and the navy. They've been issued out to all of the training establishments and all of our members and distributed, you know, throughout the organization, so that on day one, for a Sikh to feel included, they can go, here's your uniform, everybody, and actually, because you're a Sikh, here's your dress guide, which shows you how you wear your turban and how you wear your articles of faith in relation to your own uniform and where you would get your turban from, which fits with your uniform. And what makes it more complicated is you don't obviously just have one uniform, you have lots of different uniforms. So it's like, how do you get your very what are the correct different colors that you need to get, and how do you wear your badges and your sashes and all the other things that go with it. So it's a way of making people feel included and part of the organization. And another thing that was given was, for example, if you join the military, you get given a Bible on day one. Well, actually, a Bible is a religious text which we would respect, but it's not necessarily the book that we would necessarily choose to pray from. So what we've done is we've, with the help of the Ministry of Defence, has developed a tactical Sikh prayer book, so that Sikhs can be issued with their own prayer book, which is relevant to them, and they can use it in the field and have it with them at all times. So again, it's a way of making people feel more included. Say it's really important because, you know, our forces and our civil servants could be sent anywhere in the world at any different given time. So for them to be able to have access to things like the, you know, their prayer books are really important to be able to connect.
Can I just go back to your dress guide?
Yeah, absolutely.
Who's the dress guide for?
So the dress guide is for anybody who joins the army, the navy, or the air force that happens to be a Sikh. And then what will happen is when you get told that, you know, you wear your military uniform this way, the dress guide is sort of like an appendix, which then tells you how your turban or how your beard or how your articles of faith are worn in relation to the uniform that you're going to be wearing.
And that was developed from people in the network.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh wow, it's very helpful and very pragmatic, isn't it?
Absolutely. So yeah, we got our members together. We had a photo shoot. So they were all in their different uniforms. One May Day, you know, wearing their, you know, winter uniforms, summer uniforms, everything in one go. You know, doing a photo shoot so we can then, you know, have these images available, so it can be openly demonstrated. And then there's explanations in the guide, which sort of set out exactly how things should be worn and how, for example, so there's simple things like in the army they have these cap badges, for example, and they have to be adjusted so that they can be worn on the turban. As opposed to just pinned onto a cap. So we put guidance in on how you can adapt your badge so it can fit on the turban and things like this. And what's the correct way of wearing your ribbon if you wear a ribbon, or there's all these dangly bits that are worn at particular times and all this sort of stuff. So it just gives all of those instructions.
And how are sashes worn differently by Sikhs?
So they're not worn differently by Sikhs, but they're worn differently by there's different types of things that are worn differently by different services. And depending on what you're wearing in terms of, so sometimes there's a ribbon that goes around the turban, which would normally go around a cap, for example. And it's like, well, how is that correctly worn around your turban? So things like that. So, and if you're wearing, for example, a gurban, which is the, Sikhs wear a, what sometimes is defined as a dagger, although I don't like to describe it as a dagger, but it's worn around the top of the body, how that fits in with anything else that you might be wearing on the top of your body, for example. Military kit.
And you talked about the articles of faith. And can you just describe what they are?
So a lot of people think the turban is one of the five K's, and the reason they call the five K's is because all five start with the letter K, not in English but in Gurmukhi, which is the Sikh's traditional language. So we've got the gada, which is a it's a bracelet, so it's worn around the wrist. Then we have a kirpan. But it's like a, it's just, you can describe it as a small dagger. And it's worn around the upper body, across like this. And it's to show that we have to be able to fight against persecution of people. Then we have what's called, it's a wooden comb called a ganga, which is worn in the back of the hair up here, where our hair is tied up. The hair is one of them, uncut hair. So I don't cut my hair. So my beard is not cut, even though it's been tied up. It's actually not cut. It's actually long beard. And many people will choose to keep it open as well. But some of these things, for example, tying my beard up, for example, is a tradition that started with the British military, because when many of the Sikhs joined the British military in the 1850s, a way of wearing your beard started to be to tie it up. So both my grandfathers were World War II veterans from the British Army. So my family tradition has just become to tie our beards up. Well, that's where it comes from. And then we've got gashada, which are a pair of underpants that are worn under your clothes.
So those are the 5 Ks then, and the conga and the kirpan that you had, they were small. I mean, that's kind of, they're not practical, are they? They're symbolic.
So the kirpan, for example, my mum's a, so I'm not an initiated Sikh, so I don't wear the full version of it. But my mum, for example, is initiated. As a Sikh, it means we are learners of a tradition that was started by Guru Nanak. The 10th Sikh guru, who was the last human guru, brought about a form of initiation, which is for people who are going to basically commit to giving their lives for the freedom of others. Okay. And in order to do that, there is a practice that you live by. And so they're known as the Khalsa Sikhs. And you would do is, if you join the Khalsa, then you're making a commitment that you will die, not die to protect other people, to be able to live with freedom, and protection. So basically, it's a big commitment that you're giving. An anglicized version of it could be a baptism ceremony, for better word. Whereas my mum has been initiated. Now, the initiation we don't do at birth. For us, it's about choosing the right path for us. So those that are prepared to be Sikh and to follow the Sikh faith and to have a way of life, which is it's a wonderful way of life. Then when you make the commitment, you go through an initiation ceremony, and that initiation ceremony you do as and when you choose, when you're able to make that decision. So obviously, as an adult generally, and it tends to be somebody who's of sound mind. So for example, my mum didn't get initiated till she was in her 40s. I'm in my 40s, so there's still hope for me yet, but I haven't, so I'll decide when that time is right, if it ever is, really. But so that just differentiates between those that are initiated versus those that are non-initiated.
Yeah, thank you. And what do you find so wonderful about it? You said it's a wonderful way of life. What is wonderful about it?
So what's wonderful about it is, I think, let me go back to the things that I use as within my leadership statement, probably, which I get from my Sikh faith, right? So one of the things that I talk about is, I'm a compassionate leader, right? So compassion is at the heart of everything I do. It's about making sure I look after others and look out for others. The second thing I love is authenticity in my leadership statement. So I'd like to be authentic as possible, Now, authenticity is a difficult thing because I've realized throughout my life that authenticity can mean different things to me at different times, because as we grow and as we develop, we learn more about ourselves, and there's lots of things that we're influenced by. And the person I am today is different to the person I was 10 years ago, to the person I was 30 years ago. So to be as authentic as possible is really important. All right, so be yourself. And then the third thing, which is really important to me in my leadership statement, is around service. So service is a huge part of Sikhism. It's about serving others. It's about sharing with others. It's about giving to others. And to me, that's really important as well. And that I can demonstrate probably through the charitable pursuits I get involved with, the interfaith work I like to get involved in. Yeah, all those sorts of things are really important to me.
How do you go about practicing your faith in at work then, Pritpal?
So for me, one of the most simplest things could be around
Right.
meditation, right? So I can meditate without anybody even knowing being around me if I feel stressed. So it's a very similar way to, when you sort of
Yeah.
say count to 10, seek, I just go, just meditate. Right. So it's a similar sort of way. So it's a way of being able to help yourself, regulate yourself. It's a way to be able to check in with yourself. It's a way of being able to have a pause for thought, and just to be able to connect with the divine who resides within us all. Okay. The other thing I need it helps me do is, as a Sikh, what we talk about is if you can't see God in all, you can't see it God at all. So it's about seeing other people as a connection to yourself, and to the wider universe that we're all part of. Okay. So that's bringing us very much back down to the basics around treating people in a decent way that you would expect to be, in a way that you would be expected to be treated as well, perhaps. So it very much reminds you about all of these very simple things that we about how to be a human. Okay. Let's see everybody as you wish to be seen. Let's treat everybody as you might wish to be treated.
And how does Sikhism treat the afterlife?
So we believe in the afterlife. So there's a cycle of birth and death. The human form is the highest form of rebirth. So to be born as a human, we are really lucky because we have the brain power to be able to do things like meditate and connect with the divine. It gives us a higher ability to be able to come out of the cycle of birth and death, and to merge with the formless, which some people would call God. We just call the force or the power or the almighty. There's very many ways of expressing the term God, but we certainly don't see God. I mean, when growing up in the UK, in a very Christian country, singing hymns at school and all that sort of stuff, I very much really struggled as a child to understand that how does the old man with a long grey beard in the sky connect with my Sikhism? And I say to people, if you want to understand Sikhism, what you need to do is, first of all, scrub out the ism from Sikhism, because we call it Sikhi, so Sikhi, and that's the term that most Sikhs would prefer to use, the original form. And as soon as you make it an ism, then you're making it into what's called a religion. And I wouldn't call it a religion, because most, if you look at Eastern faiths like Hinduism, Sikhism, Buddhism, most of these are ways of life than necessarily religions that you follow rules from a book, which tends to be far more related to sort of the religions from that come from the Middle East, like Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, which tend to be sort of rules-based. Whereas if you look at Eastern philosophies, they are philosophies, they are ways of life. I'd call them faiths rather than
Right.
religions.
One of the last question was about your experience as a bisexual Sikh man. Are you happy to talk about
Absolutely. So I do lots of work in the LGBT space, both within faith communities, but also just more broadly with young people, but also within the Sikh community too.
that? What's your experience been?
So it's interesting, because coming out as somebody who happens to be LGBT and of faith is difficult, because it's never spoken about in the faith context. But when you realize that whatever your label will be, and actually this is me, you then have the next question around, well, can I be bisexual or gay or lesbian and Sikh? for example, with the next question, because you never, I've never come across a, before at that point, I had never come across anybody else who was LGBT and Sikh. And you so in your head, you're thinking, well, how can those two identities sit together? And it can be actually quite an existential crisis, because I can't not be who I am as a bisexual man, but I also cannot see myself being anything other than a Sikh, right? Because that's who I am to the core. So it can represent quite a conflict. But it's actually, as I say, the reason authenticity for me is really important probably comes back to this part point as well, around being able to accept myself for who I am. And in the Sikh faith, for example, we talk about truth being the highest thing that we can have in this world. So how can I call myself a Sikh if I won't accept the truth about myself? Okay, so that's how I brought the two identities together to understand, well, actually, we're told that there is nothing higher than truth. And if I can't be truthful about who I am and my identity, then I can't really be a Sikh. So I would then fail on both accounts. So one of the really important things for me is to make sure that I go out and, one, be visible. And I'm going to use the representation of fly the flag in this area, because it's really important for me to be able to talk. One, to show people that there are lots of people with of diverse backgrounds that happen to be part of the LGBT community as well. One, so that the LGBT community can see it, because there are lots of stereotypes around what a gay man or a man who sleeps with other men would look like. And it doesn't look like this, or somebody with a religious identity. But there's also a lot of hostility actually within the LGBT community towards religion anyway, generally. And that's not just me saying it as a Sikh, but I've had Christian friends tell me that they found it harder to come out as Christian to people in the LGBT community than come out as LG or B or T even. So it just goes to show that it's really important. But when I go into LGBT spaces with my faith identity, that for me, then I'm holding that space not just for Sikhs, I'm holding that space for people of faith, to show that we, as people of faith, as believers of the divine, have a space and need space as well, and we're part of the community and we need to be recognized. But then there's the other side of it as well, which is, as a bisexual man, being able to go navigate the Sikh community too, to be able to say, I happen to be from the LGBT community, and we need to make sure that this is a place of safety, it's a place of security for us as well, and our needs are being met. And that can be quite a challenge too, because quite often that's a difficult conversation to have in faith spaces.
Yeah, myself and a colleague, we've just finished writing a book about LGBTQ plus in the workplace. It'll be out next year, and we've got a section looking at LGBT and minorities. This is this idea that you're kind of not accepted in either community, not accepted from your minority community, but you're not accepted because actually you're just an unusual individual and being a minority, a sexual minority. But and you're not accepted by the, this is what the research shows, you're not accepted by the LGBT community because of racism. Is that something that you've experienced?
So I have, yes, absolutely, I have experienced that. And that's why I think workplaces are a really important place to be able to have things like networks, because what you're doing is you're then coming into contact with many people who come from many different backgrounds, and to be able to sort of openly have the space to talk about these various different characteristics that form all of us, we are all different. To be able to have those spaces, particularly talk about some of those minority perspectives that people might not necessarily encounter, are really important. Again, having been, a single dad, for example, with two children from a previous straight relationship, that again is another intersectional side that few people understand or get to know about. But actually, I'm involved in a huge network of what's called GADs, gay dads, who are men who had children in straight relationships and then happen to have a same-sex partner or relationship, or might even have came out at a later stage. Coming out to your children, there's nothing harder than that, as I can tell you. But actually, I was quite fortunate, because I came out to my children at a very young age, and they've always been allies, and they've always been very loving and supportive of me.
Thank you so much. Well, that just amazing, actually. And thank you for being so generous with, not just with your time, actually, but with your sharing your experiences and your huge knowledge and expertise. It's been really enlightening.
You're most welcome. Thank you for your time as well.
Once again, thank you very much, Pritpal, for sharing so generously with us today. It was a pleasure and an education, actually, to learn so much about the Sikh faith and your work with the Defence Sikh Network. And thank you all for listening, and I look forward to you joining us again soon for our next episode.